The World Health Organization defines addiction as a chronic relapsing condition. Dayhab Private Hospital recognizes that addiction is a multifaceted illness affecting an individual's physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, social, and practical well-being. With 28 and 90-day residential rehabilitation programs and Dayhab's accredited private health fund approved treatment service, you or your loved one can get the help you need to navigate the rehabilitation process to regain control, to overcome that addiction, and to take back your life. If this resonates, then take the first step and call Dayhab Private Hospital for addiction treatment. Addiction is treatable and recovery is possible. 1-800-329-422 or dayhab.com.au. Dayhab is one word, D-A-Y-H-A-B, dayhab.com.au. G'day team, welcome to another instalment of your favourite podcast and mine, The You Project. Hi, Melissa.
Hello, how are you?
I look, I'm pretty good. Melissa Marie Cameron over there at The You Project Central, of course. Groundbreaking times here at us.com because we've got new beanies in stock.
We do. They have arrived.
Now,
very exciting.
They have arrived, but they are at your joint and your joint is an hour from my joint. And because we're in lockdown, because we're in Armageddon, we're at the apocalypse, the end of the world is coming and we're locked down for 5 days, you can't drive over and give me a beanie. So I said to you, well, could you put one on your scone? Now, yeah, I don't care. Fuck it. I'm telling the world. I said, could you put one on your head and take a photo so that we can perhaps use that for, you know, for the website? And you're like, nah.
Are you trying to twist my arm here?
No, I'm not trying to guilt you into anything at all. That'd be the first thing from my mind. That'd be coercion and manipulation. I wouldn't think of that because that's inappropriate. But it would be good if you would put a cap on a beanie on your head and take a photo so that we can then show the world what they look like.
Well,
can I get a yes?
Well, by the time this episode's up, that photo is either going to be live or not. But the alternative is I could just express post one to you, and you could put it on your head.
Yeah, but I don't want that. I don't want that. I'm still the boss of you, technically. I know not. I know not in reality. But how has your day been?
Oh, it has been great, thank you. And my head has been warm.
Well, I'm glad you have a warm head. I'm glad we have beanies. We've got programs coming up. We've got the Becoming Ungiveupable workshop coming up on August the 4th, which is a Wednesday night between 8 and 10. And we've got our six-week mentoring program starting on August 11th. Is that correct?
Very good.
Is Wednesday. Go to my website, which is craigharper.net. Go to events, click on that, and you can read what it's all about, or you can buy a ticket and get on board, or you can just peruse and maybe see a picture of Melissa in a beanie. Who knows? Who knows what will be there by the time you see this? Now, today on the show, The You Project, it's called, we've got a friend of mine. Well, we're kind of friends. We know each other. We pass each other in the hallways of Monash. If there were hallways, we would pass each other in them. They're not really. She's a fellow PhD student, but unlike me, she's a real PhD student and really clever. Her name is Kavya Raj, and she joins us on The You Project. Hi.
Hello. How are you doing?
We're doing really well. Thanks for coming to hang out with us for a half hour or so.
No, thank you. I was a bit nervous coming in, but you've persuaded me very thoroughly and you've been so wonderful.
Well, you know, we do what we can. And after hearing me and Melissa, mainly me, talk shit for 3 minutes, you probably go, oh, this is not anything to be intimidated by at all. So you were telling us before we went live, and I'm going to throw you under the bus as well as throwing Melissa under the bus with the beanie, the way that you get through lockdown is primarily alcohol. Now, workshop that with us.
I mean, look, let's hope that none of my fellow addiction people are listening to this, because they're going to be like, you're saying one thing, you're doing another, Carb. This is not what your research is about. But yeah, look, the odd drink here and there, I have to admit, I am partial to a good cocktail. And I mean, I think of it as skill building. In COVID, I've become very, very good at just a few key cocktail recipes. And I think there's a real strong, I mean, scientifically speaking, I'm finding a real relationship between the frequency of the odd cocktail per week and the level of happiness that I am feeling.
Oh, wow. Have you found any kind of significant correlation?
Oh, yeah. Look, I think my partner would say that I am a nicer human. So for his sake, I think it's great if I have maybe like a cocktail every 3 days, just kind of space them out.
Right.
Not too frequent, not too far apart.
What does your partner do?
It's a really good question. You'd hope I'd know the answer.
Do you actually know?
No.
Are you like one of those kids who doesn't really know what their dad does for a job?
He talks to me about it and I smile and nod and I'm like, yep. Yeah.
Could you tell us what industry?
He's in financial tech. So he works in startup companies. And from my understanding, he helps them raise equity. So working with some really cool companies like Sheba, the female-only rideshare app. And recently he's done like some more financial tech companies and some breweries. So it's a bit of a mixed bag.
That sounds like an actual job. I mean, that sounds like... My mum's been waiting, Kavya, since I was, well, she's been waiting forever for me to get a proper job because what I do, it's not an actual job.
Oh, come if you on don't now.
Have, no, if you don't have work care and holidays and holiday pay and, you know, all that kind of grown-up stuff and a set weekly income, mum's not too sure about what I do. She knows I make a few dollars, but it's not really a job though. But do you know what? I would say, so I started PTing. I started in gyms when I was 18, writing programs, working on the gym floor, and started personal training at 23, 24, when both of you were just twinkles in your mum's eyes, right? Right. And then by the time I set up my first gym at 26, and I would say I was 5 years into gym ownership. I probably had 30 staff. I had 2 centers by that stage. You know, we were going... We were kind of quite groundbreaking in Australia. We were the only ones. And it took until I'd literally been doing it for maybe 10 years before mum went, oh, okay, it's a thing. It's an actual thing.
You know what? I really feel your pain. I'm sure a few of your listeners will feel this pain as well. I have a very ethic mum, and bless her heart, the woman loves me to the moon and back and, you know, would do anything for me. But
did you say you have a very ethnic mum?
Very ethnic mum.
What does that even mean?
Well, you're about to find out.
Well, tell everyone what ethnicity.
So she's South Indian, and she really fits the stereotype, you know, feeder, just constantly giving food to anyone and everyone, but just has this concept in her mind of like, PhD not being a real job. And it's like, well, I mean, she's not wrong, but I'm just still this like baby student, and she doesn't really understand what I do. And you know, every week I'll get that question of like, so what is it you do again? You know, what's happening at school? She calls it school as well. I'm not in a lab. No, I still go to school every day. And you know, I just don't think she's ever gonna fully understand what it is that I do for a living.
When I started at Monash doing my PhD, now my mum was 75% serious and 25% joking when she said to me, my at the time 80-year-old mum said to me, is there a parent-teacher night? And I went, oh my God, I hope so. Because I definitely want to take you and Ron to sit down with Murat. And
can we just set one up?
Oh,
can we just
God.
Pretend that there is
how
one?
Fucking hilarious and gorgeous.
Murat would love that. He would adore it.
We would definitely film that.
Yeah, yeah.
That would definitely become a YouTube sensation. Is 56-year-old PhD student takes his parents for a parent-teacher night, and I just sit there in the corner looking forlornly. What Murat tells my parents some hard truths about how bad I am. That would be, you know, when you're talking about your mum, the feeder. Now, my mum is not ethnic, but she should be. I think
is she
my
a feeder
mum
too?
All of my mum's friends are Italian and Greek, most of them. So I think my mum thinks she's Italian and Greek. So if I'm going for dinner and there's Ron and Mary, now Mary eats like a sparrow. She weighs 12 kilos, right? Like you could put her in your pocket and just walk around with her. She's, bless her, right? But my left leg is way bigger than Mary. But she, so there's me and Ron and her. Now, I'll get there on a Saturday night and she will dish up food for, I'm not even bullshitting, 12 people. And I go, when are the multitudes coming, Mum? Like, what is this about? But then, so we'll eat and there'll be obviously 80% of it left over. And then when I leave, she goes to the freezer and she gets out a big freezer bag and then she loads rock bottom 16 to 20 meals that she cooked me the day before. Because clearly, having lived by myself for 40 years, I don't know how to cook and I'm clearly going to die of some kind of eating disorder or malnutrition in the next week or two.
You know what, Craig? I'll share a secret with you. My mum, to this day, bless her, I've lived out of home for so many years and I've been taking care of myself just fine in that time. But bless her, to this day, she calls me every day to ask me if I've had breakfast and lunch and if I'm okay and if I've eaten a good meal. And she just still thinks I'm going to die of starvation on the roadside. At this age, she still thinks I can't cook for myself.
But you're not that old. How old are you?
26.
26. My shoes are 26. My sneakers are literally 26 years old.
Those are good sneakers then.
That's hilarious. 26. Well, all right, let's talk about what you're actually doing. So if you missed it at the start, Kavya is part of Brain Park. She's a PhD student and we kind of work vaguely in the same space. So tell us firstly, where are you at in your PhD journey?
Sadly, at the sort of 3-year mark, I kind of am living in denial about that one. Any fellow PhD students will be listening, I'm sure they'll understand that feeling. Towards the end, there's light at the tunnel, Craig. I've got nine months left.
Why is that sad?
I feel like I should have done more than what I have. I kind of feel like I've just sort of stumbled my way along and magically have ended up here. And I don't quite know how I've ended up here, but here I am nonetheless. 3 years in.
What did you do before your PhD? Did you do honours? Did you do masters? You did undergrad, obviously. What did you do before this?
Yeah, I had kind of the sort of stereotypical pathway towards academia. I knew from a young age that I wanted to go to uni. That was just kind of like my focus in school. And it was like I had blinkers on. I was just like, I just got to get to uni. I've got to do this. Really loved psychology and I thought, this is what I want to do. And at the time, I actually wanted to be a clinician, funnily enough, wanted to be a psychologist. I'd be a horrific psychologist. So it's a good thing I didn't pick that career.
Why do you say that?
Oh, the frequent need for naps. I just don't think would suit the lifestyle of a psychologist.
Maybe you should have been a cat.
I should run one of those cat cafes where people come in with their pets. That'd be great. You could just sleep in the back room.
I think your PhD might be wasted, but anyway.
So it's a good thing I didn't become a psych, but yeah, I did my undergrad in psychology and philosophy and loved it. And I thought, you know what? This is going well. Let's apply for honours, because in the psych realm, it's kind of mandatory to do honours. It's just sort of a given if you want to continue on. And that was really my first exposure to research. And I thought research was horrendous and really sort of vile and difficult and uninteresting. And then I actually did it and I thought, oh, wow, this isn't that bad. Science is pretty fun. And that tricked me into doing a PhD, because I thought, you know what? I've survived honours. How bad could it really be? It's fine. It's not fine. But I thought it was going in. So finished honours. I was really lucky to be in the lab that was sort of the precursor to Brain Park. So I knew Murat from a very young age, and he was very, very kind to offer a PhD place for me if I wanted to ever come back. And a few years of time off, did a little bit of work to clear my head, to get a bit of money saved up, convinced my mother that I would be okay, that I could get a real job. And then just, yeah, applied for the thesis placement like 2 years after honours, and back into it I came.
And when you do graduate and you are a grown-up, what would you like to do?
Oh, the million-dollar question.
What's on the maybe list?
So the dream...
Other than drink and travel, what would you like to do as a career?
I mean, is there really much outside of life beyond drinking and traveling? That's the other question. The dream job would be if I could be in research and I could stay in mental health but avoid the sort of, how do I put it politely, the sort of shit situation that is grants and government funding and getting postdoc positions and all of that jazz. Science, I've discovered, is just really, really difficult to get funding for and stay in. And so if I could stay in science and mental health, where I'm helping people, I'm doing meaningful research, but I don't have to stress every single year about, oh, crap, am I going to get funded? Is the government actually going to let me have a job? That would be the dream. So I'd love to work for a mental health organisation like Beyond Blue and do research for them.
Just explain to people who don't get the, you know, the way that it works for research is that there is, I mean, it's not like everyone at Brain Park or any university for that matter that does research. It's not like there's just this ongoing guaranteed job or this, there's just this fixed stream of income or there's this well of money that can be tapped into. It's an ongoing process of trying to get money to survive. Can you explain how that works a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was actually something that was really new to me, and I had no idea for many years until I hit the PhD level that, oh, this is how it works. I thought if you're a researcher, your job is with the university and the university pays you like a standard employer. Sadly, no. So in academia, the way it works is that most people every year apply to the government. So there's different sort of health organizations in the government, different bodies, and you apply to them every year for funding. And that's called the grant season or grant proposals. And you basically pitch the study that you want to do. It's literally like doing a business pitch, and you outline who your team is, what you want to do, your timeline, your budget, your outcomes, why you want to do it, you know, how this is actually going to help the community or Australians, and really have to sell yourself and the study. And maybe, just maybe, you're one of the lucky ones who gets approved. But I can't remember the stat off the top of my head, Craig. Maybe you know how many people actually get funded, but it's not the majority, that's for sure.
No, it's pretty small.
It's pretty small, yeah. And so that was a bit of a shock for me coming into science. I was a bit naive and I thought, oh yeah, it's great. Like, of course people would fund science. Of course people want to pay for us to answer these questions about mental health and well-being, and, you know, they're really important aspects of people's lives. And the reality is that it's just a lot harder to have funding than I thought it was. And so, yeah, every year you kind of got to go through that circus and see if it sticks. And sometimes you're lucky and sometimes you're not.
Well, we've had a lady called Professor Sharon Ricardo, who's a friend of mine, on the podcast a bunch of times. And she's the head of, what is she the head of, Melissa? Is it like
student admissions or something? Like it's the PhD?
No. Her research area is biomedicine, I think.
Yeah.
And so she's the head of that. She's a genius, but she also does other uni stuff. But she literally spends her life writing grant proposals or whatever you call it. And I mean, obviously doing research, but she spends a disproportionate, unhealthy amount of time trying to get funding to keep doing the science that kind of the world needs. So anyway, it is what it is. What are you doing your PhD in?
Good question. So how do I say this, long story short?
So no, not your actual research, but are you doing neuroscience, neuropsych?
No, so cognitive psych. Cognitive psychology is the broad domain that I'm in. I started out in neuropsych.
Yep.
And after a year, we decided to switch to cognitive psych. So for people who aren't familiar with psych, neuropsychology is really trying to understand how our emotions and our thoughts relate to aspects of our brain and sort of the function and the structure of our brain. And then cognitive psychology is more just purely about understanding our patterns of thinking and feeling, things like our personality traits, broader aspects of our mental health. So yeah, that's my broad domain.
Perfect. Now tell us about your research. What are you actually researching?
I am researching internet addiction, as it is sort of colloquially known as. So I look specifically at how university students use the internet and what mental health effects their excess time online is having.
That's catch 22, isn't it? Because if you're a university student, you've got to use the internet, you've got to use a computer, you've got to be online. I mean, we're not doing it with butcher paper and crayon, although I wish that was the case, because I'd be so fucking good at PhD land. I would just send all my assignments by carrier pigeon to Brain Park with a little Murat note around his or her carrier pigeon's leg. So how are you doing the research? What kind of things are you doing?
Yeah, so exactly like you said, it is a bit of a catch-22, and students are just kind of in a shit situation, more so than they've really ever been, especially with COVID. What we've seen is that, I mean, as obvious as it sounds, obviously, the internet's not going away. We're never going to not do our work online, at least not in the near future. And so we're expecting students to do their assignments online, access their course material online, study online, learn all this information, and somehow miraculously not also get distracted by the exact same medium that offers things like Netflix, YouTube, social media, Reddit, games. And it's that the same thing that is the source of work and productivity is the exact same thing that is the source of distraction and potential addiction. So,
wow. What just came to mind to me then, I was thinking about something that's analogous. And I guess in a very weird way, food is analogous, because you can have a destructive relationship with food. You can eat too much. You can kill yourself with it. You can make yourself obese and give yourself diabetes, and or you can use it in a way which is really positive and intelligent and healthy. So I guess there's quite a few things, and I know there's a big jump from food to the internet, but ultimately it's a resource for us, and how we use it is the determinant of the impact, good or bad, that it will have on us.
Absolutely.
So what are you, before we dive into what your research is telling us, just broadly, what did you think going in, or were you a blank canvas? Did you have certain expectations?
Oh, I mean, perhaps my memory is not accurate. I like to think I was a blank canvas. I like to think I was a good scientist and I didn't have too many biases or expectations. I mean, like you said, I'm in a younger age group. I'm 26. When I started my PhD, I was even younger. And I'm in the age group where people have grown up with the internet. I've used it almost my whole life. And I, even though I research it, I know I use my phone and my laptop too much. So I guess I had some expectations around the legitimacy of the issue. At the time that I started it, there was still a lot of debate around, is this even a thing? I mean, people, like you said, with food, in the sort of general behavioral addiction space, people love to say things like, well, it's not really a problem. It's the internet. You can't really be addicted to the internet or things like that. subjectively and seeing people of my age group, I think I went into it with the expectation of this is a real thing. Phenomenologically, just looking at people my age, they do have problems with their phone. They do have problems with their time online. Whether we label that an addiction or something else, there is something to it. So I think I went in with the expectation of it being a problem and being valid. And that maybe coloured my views. But other than that, I'd say blank slate.
Yeah, so not blank at all. Okay. No, good disclaimer, but I'm not buying it. I mean, here's the thing, right? It's the same. Like, I go into my process. Of course, I've got ideas and beliefs and expectations and assumptions because we're human. It's like our mind is not an empty vessel. Like, the idea of being completely objective is lunacy, because we are subjective creatures experiencing and processing the world all the time. So if you have a pre-existing relationship with the internet, which we all do, then you're already being influenced in a way. But what you're doing is you're doing your research as methodically and as altruistically as possible. You know, but I was thinking that, like when you said, is it an addiction? Is it a thing? That's what they were thinking a few years ago. My kind of litmus test is whether or not it's drugs, food, booze, porn, internet in general, you know, gambling is, does it have, what's the emotional, psychological, physiological, sociological consequence? Can it impact, is there a negative impact or could there be a negative impact? And the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So can excessive use of the internet impact people's physical, mental, emotional, social health? Can it impact it negatively? 100%. So therefore it can potentially, what is the hesitance, Kavya, around, I've noticed this a little bit at Brain Park, where we're talking about stuff with our Monday meetings at 12, and I'll explain that in a minute to everyone, is sometimes the hesitancy around calling something an addiction. Like, does it need to meet certain criteria to be an addiction versus a compulsion or just a nasty habit?
So this is, it's a really good question, and it's something that I have sort of had ruminating away in the back of my head for a while. Before I actually started my thesis in the internet addiction space, my PhD was actually going to be about gambling, which is a recognized behavioral addiction. So globally, most academics have come to the conclusion that, yep, in the same way that drugs can be addictive, gambling is also addictive. And so that was where I started out. And then I slowly shifted to internet. And I realized very quickly that there's a huge divide, like you said, between people who call it an addiction and then people who are very hesitant to call it that and call it something like problematic internet use or compulsive internet use. The funny thing is that, sorry, like spoiler alert, we actually don't have a very good understanding of defining addictions to begin with.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of people will hear things like, oh, it's all about the reward system and, you know, drugs have this dopamine response and like, it's all about the dopamine. That doesn't really hold up that well when you look at the research. There's some that support it and some that don't. Not all drugs have that dopamine effect. And so, yeah, okay, reward important, but perhaps not. Perhaps, like you said, it's got more of that emotional side. I think it's that people are very hesitant to label something an addiction and attach the stigma to it. Mm-hmm. I think, unfortunately, socially, there's a huge stigma around saying something is an addiction because people get called addicts. They get given that label. And so the idea is that before you label something an addiction, you need to have all of the supporting genetic evidence, the neurobiology, the years and years of testing before you give it that framework. But it's really interesting because when you look at things like sex addiction or food addiction, whatever you want to call it, things that aren't labeled as official conditions receive less support from healthcare providers, because there's, at least in a public sense, there's only so much you can do. So in some ways, by choosing not to label something as an addiction and have it not legitimately recognized in a clinical sense, it's actually really hard for people who are experiencing those issues to then receive support, because we haven't called it an addiction. We haven't legitimized it.
Is there I'm just thinking out loud. I don't expect you to know all these answers, but for me, an addiction manifests with something where I do this thing that I know is not good. Whatever the thing is, I know this is excessive. I know this is not good for my mind or my brain or my lifestyle or my perhaps mental or physical health or relationships or bank balance, but I can't control it. I can't control it. I want to. I even know what I'm doing, but I still do it. And I intend not to do it, but I still do it. Like for me, and I know I'm not the decision maker of what is and what isn't, although I fucking should be. But
just Craig as the chief of the DSM
making
all
imagine choices. If everyone just goes, Harps, here's the evidence. I go, oh, hang on, yep, that's an addiction. Next. That would be the world's worst system. We definitely don't need me in charge of anything more than I'm currently in charge of, because even what I'm in charge of, I struggle. But I just, you know, it is interesting the way that things get labeled or defined or accepted or not accepted, but eventually a lot of the things that were rejected eventually become accepted. So is internet addiction a thing? Is it a recognized thing or not?
Funnily enough, so components of it are gaming disorder. That was the rage 10 years ago. Oh my God, everyone was talking about video gaming and how video games were these horrendously bad things for our health. And so internet gaming disorder is recognized in Europe and I think North America as a clinical disorder.
Right.
Internet addiction or excessive internet use, whatever you want to call it, it's classified as a condition warranting further research. So they're at the moment saying there's something there. We know something's there. We know something's going on. We just don't know what that something is.
Right.
And so we need more research trying to figure out what that something is. But that explanation that you gave, funnily enough, is that's the exact explanation I use of I'm doing something. I know it's bad for me. I'm very cognizant of the fact that it's not healthy and it's not helping me, but I just can't stop myself. And yeah, it's always that statement of, I just can't stop myself. I'm trying really hard not to do it, but I just can't.
Yeah. Despite the fact that I keep starting and I keep intending, yeah, and I've given it up 37 times in the last 2 months.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I'm back here. So what's the question that you're asking, the question or questions that you're asking in your research?
I guess sort of it bubbles down to three questions. Question one being, how many people is this affecting? You know, we understand from past work that the number of people and the way that they experience internet addiction is really dependent on their culture and their country. And I mean, once you get into it, it kind of makes sense, because culturally, the way that we use the internet is really dependent on where we're from and how it's integrated in our lifestyle. And so you see hugely, hugely different rates of prevalence from country to country and age group to age group. And so it really depends. Trying to identify how many people are suffering or experiencing this problem, you can't just kind of say, well, the global prevalence rate of depression is blah. You have to really look at it on a sort of finer level and try and understand how many people are being affected. And when I started, we had no idea how many people in Australia were experiencing this. No one had actually bothered to look at that. So question one was, how many people does this affect? And we chose to look specifically at students, because out of every age group, they experience it the worst. They almost have a 5 times greater risk of having internet addiction than people in the general community. And I think it's lifestyle. You know, you're at uni, you're in control of your life for the first time, you're an adult, you've gone to lectures, but you've got so much free time now, you don't have a real job. And so they tend to experience it the most. So that was question one. Question two was, what's going on in the mind, what's actually happening here in terms of your mental health, in terms of the way that you think and the way that you behave. What is happening with internet addiction? How does it change the way that we think, feel, and act? And then the third question was, well, can we actually do anything to help? Because it's all well and good trying to answer these questions about what it is and who it affects and how it progresses, but none of that really, really matters if you can't actually provide people with tangible solutions. And so we've been running, or just about to start running, a study that looks at running a lifestyle intervention in partnership with Headspace for students with internet addiction.
And what is that intervention? Well done, because that's a pretty Headspace are awesome. So that's a handy partner, or that's a nice partnership. What does that intervention look like?
Yeah, so it's very simple. We really wanted it to be something that could be implemented in the average person's life. And we understand most people are already short on time. They've got a million responsibilities. You're rushing from thing to thing. So it was really, how do we do something short, sharp, and fast that people can put into their lives that can hopefully make a tangible difference in their online habits and help them build healthier lives? So we've done 30 days. We've partnered up with Headspace. It's a world first program. It's actually the first study to ever do anything like this. And it's 30 days of Headspace, 10 minutes a day. So nothing too onerous. It's very, very simple. And we get people to integrate it into their morning routine. So the same as, you know, waking up, brushing your teeth and having a coffee, so that you sit down with your headphones on for 10 minutes and it's just a part of your routine.
And what's the expectation or the hope? Like, what do you hope that will do to symptoms or, you know, whatever?
Yeah, so, I mean, to put it simply, one of the key parts of internet addiction, or kind of just behavioral addictions in general, is the lack of self-control, right? It's the knowing that you shouldn't be doing something and really struggling to control that behavior regardless, even though you know you shouldn't. I mean, how many times have we all deleted Instagram off our phone and, you know, told ourselves we're not going to check Facebook in the mornings and we're not going to binge watch Netflix this weekend? It still happens because it's really hard to control that behavior. A key part of Headspace and mindfulness in general is improving control of behavior. You become more aware, more attentive, and more able to regulate your behavior, choosing what you want to do. And so that was the thinking is, well, 30 days, it's a pretty long time in the mindfulness space. That should hopefully get people to improve their control of their behavior to a point where they're not just compulsively scrolling on social media for 3 hours on end. And they're not. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. I feel like you're right. This is so, when you use the internet a lot, when you're on a computer a lot, when you're online a lot, when you're, you know, doing all the shit you do, it is, and even me, and I'm a fucking dinosaur, it becomes an unconscious process, Kavya, where, and I'm the same, and I'm not a 26-year-old PhD student, you know, where even I go down an internet rabbit hole and come up the end an hour later and go, well, I just fell into a time vortex, and what the fuck am I, 15 years old? What am I doing? Because it is addictive, because it does create a biochemical response in you. And you're like, this is fun, this is good, and it's way better than study. Oh, look at me, I'm watching car reviews. Oh, look at me, I'm watching a bloke fucking climb Mount Everest with a house on his back or whatever it is, you know. I watch the most ridiculous shit because it distracts me. It takes me out of pain.
It's designed that way. Like the more you kind of go down the rabbit hole, you realize how cooked it is. So just taking YouTube, for example, their whole focus, their entire metric is time spent on the service and time spent watching videos. The more time you spend on their platform, the more money they make through ad revenue.
Yes.
So their whole focus, as they're making their YouTube algorithm with the recommended videos and the suggested videos and all of that, their whole algorithm for the past like 5 years or so has all been about increasing watch time. And so that's their goal. Their goal is to get you to spend more time online. It's the same with TikTok. It's the same with Instagram. These apps and these services are designed to be addictive, and they're designed to keep you sucked into that vortex. And I mean, that's even just saying it, it makes sense that that's what they want, that they are of service like any other company. But it's like being in a casino and not having any natural sunlight in there and having clocks. You know, you're not meant to realize how much time you're losing in these spaces. And whether you're physically in a casino or whether you are virtually on YouTube or Instagram, it is still that loss of time where you are completely unaware.
Cognitive dissociation. Cognitive dissociation. But you know what else is really interesting? It just dawned on me, what you said is so insightful. Like literally your addiction is profitable for them.
Yep, 100%. Like, oh my
literally,
God.
Literally their ability to addict people, not that they would ever say that, but it's certainly, I mean, if we're, of course, this is, you know, this is horrible. We don't want this. This is fucking immoral. I get it. But if we're just talking from a commercial perspective, having all of these people addicted to their product who can't control themselves is highly profitable.
Yep. Exactly.
What a great business. I put that in italics. What a great business plan.
YouTube is one of the most profitable businesses of our time. It is obscene how much money they make. And their algorithm, like all platforms, it's an AI, and it just keeps track of how much time you spend on videos. Mm-hmm. And it goes, oh, well, you know, Joe Blow over there, he spent like an hour watching that video. I'm going to recommend this video to you as well because they spent an hour watching it, and then you'll spend an hour watching it. And it just is this cycle where every single video that gets recommended to you is designed to keep you watching.
Yeah.
And it's they are making money off of you spending your time doing it, and your time on that site is time that you should probably be spending with your friends and family. It's time that you should be spent sleeping, doing your work, being productive, engaging in hobbies, being physically active. We see a huge decrease in physical activity in people who experience internet addiction.
How many studies are you doing over the course of your PhD?
Three in total. So we've finished two. We're done with two, and we're up to the very last one with Headspace. And it's been pretty confronting seeing the results coming out of this, actually.
Keep going. You can't go. This is you. And by the way, we've found out some fucking amazing stuff at the end. What? Come on. So what do you know that you didn't know? What have you learned? What's been confronting? And what do we consumers need to know?
So one of the really confronting things, or just surprising, I would say, is that it wasn't necessarily time spent online that was the biggest factor. It was the impact that that time had on people's lives. And I think this was the big kicker for me, was just subjectively, I had tricked myself into thinking, well, you know, I don't spend that much time on the internet. I still do X, Y, and Z. I still go to the gym and I still go for walks and blah, blah, blah. You could be spending 3 hours a day of personal time on the internet, but depending on your lifestyle, the impact that that has could be so severe. So we assess internet addiction looking at impact. We look at how it impacts people's sleep, their mood, their relationships, the quality of their relationships with the people around them and the interactions that they have, and their ability to meet other responsibilities and get things done. And the sad thing is, you come across people who spend like 10, 12 hours a day on the internet, and, you know, that's kind of the stereotype that you think of. But a lot of people really aren't spending that much time online, but the time that they do spend, it's probably like midnight, 1 a.m., and they're not sleeping as a result. Or it's time when they're having dinner and rather than talking to their partner, they're on their phone playing Candy Crush.
Yeah.
And they're just replacing healthier aspects of their life with the internet, which is so easily accessible to them at all points in time. And it's just, it's really concerning when you see that it doesn't just affect their physical health. It's every single domain of someone's life. It's work, family, mood, well-being, sleep, activity. It's all of it.
We interviewed a friend of mine last week, Kavya, who's got a master's in, nutrition and a master's in ex-phys, and he's a neuroscientist, and he's also doing a PhD in psych. And he was telling us that I think the figure was people who, kids who go, did I do this one with you, Melissa, with Paul Taylor? Was it that kids who take their phones to bed and have their phones in bed, so like they literally have a tablet or a phone or a laptop in bed, are at twice, they increase their risk of mental health problems by 100%. So they're at twice the risk just by doing that one thing, by literally being, because it fucks up their REM sleep. And so, and he was talking about the quality of REM sleep and, or the amount of REM sleep and how that affects mental health, you know, sleep, what do they call it? Sleep hygiene. And there are so many, there are so many variables around this stuff, right? There are so, and internet use, like you said, it can impact everything from physical and mental health to relationships, to efficiency, to productivity, to mindset, to creativity, to energy levels. Because it's if you're spending lots of time and or energy on that, it's being taken away from something else.
Absolutely. And I think that's the thing that people, having spoken to hundreds of participants at this point, we've been lucky enough to have hundreds and hundreds of students come through our research, and you get to know all of them. You get to hear their stories and understand what's going on in their life, how their internet is affecting them. And it affects everyone differently. But one of the things that really comes out of it is that they feel like there's so much lost time and that there are so many other aspects of their life that they are falling behind in because they just cannot take themselves away from their devices and allocate their time to other things. And they're really cognizant of the fact that it's affecting their mood and the quality of their interactions and their work, and they still can't stop. And I think that's the sad part, is they're really aware that this is happening and they really see it happening, and they still keep excessively using their devices.
I think one of the biggest challenges with overcoming any kind of compulsion or addiction or negative kind of habit is that we are, to an extent, impulsive, and we also love instant gratification. And the problem is that whether it's booze or drugs or sex or internet or Facebook likes or Candy Crush or whatever it is, you know, there's that element of right now, this is fucking awesome. And but getting through that means delaying gratification and not doing it, not eating it, not using it, not drinking it, not snorting it, whatever the case is. And the change and the benefits take a while. And fuck that. We don't want to wait a while, because I can do this right now and feel awesome, or I can feel better, or I can get out a bit of, I can distract myself from the shit that is my life, or the shit that is this emotional state, or the shit that is my financial state. I can do this thing right now and transport myself. But Kavya is telling me that I've got to not do that. What I'll do is I'll start Monday, and then it's December, right? And so this is very typical with a lot of behaviors, is this kind of delaying where I'll get to it soon. But we don't, because actually overcoming any addiction, and obviously there's a scale of severity and impact of addictions, of course, but it is just sometimes a long, not very fun, not very comfortable process. And that's one of the barriers, right?
It's also, like you said, it's delayed gratification. It's also escapism. You know, what you're saying about this feels so fucking good right now, like this is amazing right now. It is that escapism. I did some research with a student of mine, and what she found was that escapism was one of the biggest predictors of internet addiction. And it's just that I spoke to a participant in a study really recently, a few days ago, and something that she said has just stuck with me. And it was that her quote was, anytime I start to feel bad, my phone is in my hand before I'm even aware of it.
Yeah.
And it was just that she's not even letting herself feel bad. It's like as it's starting to happen, as you start feeling a bit stressed, as you start feeling a bit down, you've already gone to that phone, to that computer. You've already turned on YouTube. You've already switched on Netflix. And it's just that knowledge that, you know what, I can check out of my life and I can check out of any difficult situation at any point in time that I want to with this tiny little thing, this little phone that's in my hand. It can just give me a whole other world and I don't have to deal with these difficult emotions and I don't have to deal with this stress and these really horrible situations. I can just escape into my Candy Crush game or into YouTube.
Mm. And I think sadly, I really hope I'm wrong, but I don't think this is going away anytime soon. You know, it doesn't seem to be diminishing, this addiction and this issue. It seems to be, you know, growing. How many, and again, this is not I don't expect a research-based answer. This is just a conversation, but in your guesstimation, I call this bro science. In your estimation, how many people do you think, if we just took a guess, you know, of all the people that use the internet in Australia, which is nearly everyone, how many people do you think probably somewhere on the scale between a bit unhealthy and completely toxic, how many people are on that scale? What percentage?
If we're saying the scale is from a bit unhealthy all the way up to toxic, I would say majority of the population.
Yeah.
So from our research, and again, this is in a university sample, what we found was that almost 50% of students fell into that middle group of, it's a bit shit, I have a few problems, it's definitely not healthy, that's for sure, but I can still just get by, I can still function. You know, I'm still able to hand in my work on time. It's not great, but it's okay. I'm still able to feel somewhat happy sometimes, but not all the time. So yeah. If we're talking about how many people would have, you know, a bit of an unhealthy pattern with their internet use and could be on that road to internet addiction, I would say close to like 40% of the population. That's my bro science guesstimate, Craig.
No, I like it. And I like the fact that you're having a guess, because a lot of academics won't. Well, no, I don't have the data. I know. I don't need data. We're just chatting. I need an opinion.
I'm extrapolating.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I've been working with humans and bodies since I was 18, and people ask me stuff all the time that I don't have precise data on that. But if you want my thoughts around it, and again, just thoughts, you know, X, Y, Z. And I mean, that's, you know.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's my thoughts are about 40%. I would love to be proven wrong anyone out there wants to take on that study and go ask Australians what's happening for them. But from what we've seen, most people, I think a lot of us would like to trick ourselves into thinking we're healthy and we don't have problems with our phone or our computer.
Yeah.
But numbers aren't lying, and that's not what we're getting. That is not the story that we're getting from our research. Most people have mild to moderate problems. They are somewhere on that spectrum.
All right, couple of questions before we go. Best and worst things about doing a PhD. Let's start with the best. Doesn't need to be necessarily the most fun, but just what's the best, or what's for you been the best thing about doing a PhD?
I'm going to cheat. I've got two. Is that all right, Craig?
Yeah, you can have six.
Oh, beautiful. I love it. So I'd say best numero uno is the people. And I didn't realize this until recently. When you do a PhD and when you're in that kind of academic context, you're surrounded by some of the like best, brightest, most creative, intelligent, interesting people They are so smart. The way that they think is so interesting. And they're just these wonderful people with these amazing ideas and so much passion. And being in that environment is really contagious in the best way possible. There is something so exciting about being in a room of other scientists who are doing cool shit. They're just doing cool shit and they're asking cool questions and they're running cool studies and they're so excited about what they do. That is awesome. And very, very few people get to go to work and be in that environment and be around people who are just that awesome and interesting. Part numero dos, I would say, is the lifestyle in terms of hours. I can go in when I want. I can go home when I want. I can take days off when I want to take them off. If I'm having a bad mental health day and I need to just stay in bed, there is not a single person who's going to give just any shits about what I do. I can stay in bed and no one cares. And honestly, it makes me a bit sad that other industries aren't the same because, you know, we're all adults. We're all capable of getting our stuff done. And if we need a day, we need a day. I feel like PhD life is, and academia in general, is very, very kind to people's work-life balance at times.
I love it. What's hard? What's hard about doing a PhD? Or not necessarily that you didn't enjoy it, but just what's tough?
I mean, there's a lot there that I could pick, but honestly, I think the biggest one is just how isolated you can feel at times. And I didn't realize that this was a common experience until I chatted to some other people, but when you do a PhD, it is your baby. You are taking this thing from infancy all the way through to adulthood. You are nurturing it. You are taking care of every single responsibility. You are responsible for almost every decision. It is your job to figure it out, fix the problems, learn all these skills. And it's very, very, like you have a team of people around you, but they are not responsible for doing that work. It is all on you. And I know that once you finish your PhD and you get out into the real world as a scientist, it's a bit different. You are much more part of a team. It is much more a shared responsibility. But yeah, by far, being a PhD student and just having to do all of it yourself is super challenging.
Now we have, I'm always encouraging, Kavya, people who don't see themselves as academic or great at learning in a formal setting. And whether or not that's doing a Cert 3 in fitness or a course to become a barista or to learn how to do SEO or build a website, or it's to do a PhD at Brain Park. I'm always encouraging people to learn. What are your tips and ideas for people, or what's your encouragement for people who go, yeah, but she's a genius and that's, you know, like, because I want people to keep learning, consciously learning, so they're using their brain, they're training their brain, they're training their mind, they're opening new cognitive doors, they're upskilling, they're becoming more competent and more aware, rather than sitting in this cognitive, emotional, behavioral holding pattern, if not going backwards. What are your thoughts around learning at any level and at any stage for anyone?
Two things. One, I actually used to be a barista, so
natural progression.
All baristas can become PhD students. I mean, second thing is just, it's not a chore. It's fun. And I think that's the problem. It's not necessarily the individual's problem. It's kind of the system. We grew up going to school in a way that's just a bit shit. It's not that great. It's not that fun. You have all this standardized testing and all these rules and blah, 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 blah. And that's kind of your first and only experience of education is school. And it's not that great, but learning is super fun. How amazing that you can learn things about the world around you and have all this knowledge. We have access to every single aspect of knowledge that humans have collectively like built and put together. That is fantastic. That's amazing. There is definitely something out there that every single person wishes that they knew more about, whether that's the strict traditional academia bullshit, or whether it's just learning more about skincare, learning more about makeup, learning about being a barista, learning about how cars work. There is something out there that excites everyone, whatever that might be. And I think at the end of the day, learning should be about something that excites you. You should pick a topic that makes you really curious and makes you want to know more about it.
As long as it's not on the internet, kids. Just kidding. Just kidding, Kavya. You're ace. You've been.
Thank you.
You've been great. Now, plug. I don't know if you want people to follow you on social media, if you want to mention your stuff. Not normally at this stage, we say to our guest, tell people about your book, tell people about your website, tell people about your socials. What do you want to share, if anything, with our audience?
I would love to share my research with other people. So as a typical scientist, I have a science Twitter. It's @Kavya_R. So nothing too complicated.
Spell Kavya for people.
It's Kavya_R. That is as my name, my Twitter handle. Please go have a look at my Twitter. We publish all our research on there. We talk about any new stuff that's come out about internet use. And, it would be great to see some people on there. Also, any uni students out there, as a fellow student myself who spends way too much time on their phone, we are still running our Headspace program. And so if people would like to join, and if they, like you said earlier, Craig, the internet's not going away. None of this is going away. You know, it's not going to stop being addictive or a time suck. We just have to figure out ways that we can, not delve down that rabbit hole too far. We need to come up with ways to delay that gratification, build healthier lives. And so, if that sounds like something you're interested in, then go join that Headspace program. It's 30 days, 10 minutes a day for uni students exclusively. And it would be fantastic to see some new faces in the program.
Is this your first ever podcast?
It is my first ever podcast, funnily enough.
Possibly the best debut of all time. I tell you what, you reckon, you are, for somebody that's never done a podcast, that's still a student, you're a bloody good communicator, and you reckon you would have been a shit clinician. I think you would be a brilliant clinician because you communicate amazingly well. Thank but anyway, you, that's a conversation for another day.
I'm too busy taking naps and drinking cocktails to be a psychologist, Craig.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you could figure it out. Let's say goodbye to everyone. You stay there, Kavya. Melissa, what did you think?
Oh my goodness, what a great topic. So interesting. In fact, I actually had one quick question for you, and that is, if you had guaranteed funding, what would you study next?
Social media.
Okay.
I think social media, with the rise of TikTok especially, it is becoming increasingly addictive, and the engineers at those apps know what they're doing. They really know how addictive they're making these apps. And so I'd love to learn more about what's going on in our brains when we're on TikTok and we're on Instagram and we're on Facebook. I would definitely do social media.
Oh well, that can be your next PhD. That can be your postdoc.
One isn't enough. Just do another PhD.
That's what I say. Fucking hell. Now, of course, we're going to give a shout out to Brain Park, where we both study. And who are your supervisors? Let's give them a bit of love.
Oh, the wonderful Murat, the same as you. Murat is the definition of a science dad. If anyone is considering a supervisor, hit him up. He is the best. He's so fabulous. Then the other founder and director of Brain Park, Rebecca Segrave, she is phenomenal. She's an incredible clinical supervisor and just has so much knowledge crammed into her brain. It's a miracle. Her head hasn't exploded. She's so smart. And then last but not least, Antonio Verdeo Garcia. He is an amazing addiction expert, and he's got the most incredible Spanish accent. So everything he says sounds so funny and so entertaining. He somehow makes everything really interesting. So they are my trio, my team, and yeah.
They are your academic triad, ninjas. They are your academic ninjas.
They are.
Stay there, Kavya. Thank you. Melissa, thank you. Audience, love your guts. I hope you enjoyed Kavya. We'll see you next time.
The addict in your family might need you to take the first step for them. They Have Private Hospital for Addiction Treatment has the experience, staff, resources, and processes to help you help your loved one. DAHAB's model of intensive rehabilitation has revolutionised the practice of addiction treatment in Australia. Registered with the DHHS, Department of Health and Human Services, DAHAB now offers rehabilitation programs for drug, alcohol and gambling addiction and is a private health fund approved treatment service. So if you or someone you care about is fighting addiction, there is hope. Addiction is treatable. Recovery is possible. Just ask me, call. And there is light at the end of the tunnel. DAHAB Private Hospital for Addiction Treatment. Call DAHAB on 1-800-329-422 or learn more at DAHAB, DAYHAB, or one word, .com.au.